Well, it's a beautiful summer day out there. Not as humid as it has been, and so that's a nice treat. And I look forward to that for the picnic. Just a second, my microphone is off center and it's making me lean funny. This is one thing I don't want to be as funny. But this brings up a key point. There's one day that the world does not know, and consequently it suffers too much stress, too little peace, and very little understanding of the true values of life from God's Word. And the day that they don't know is the day we're keeping now, the Sabbath. We're going to therefore look at how we keep the Sabbath, and we're going to start with a reading in Ezekiel. The title of Ezekiel chapter 20, by the way, title is The True Art of Sabbath Keeping. The True Art of Sabbath Keeping. Ezekiel 20. When you get absent-minded, you can't remember which order the major prophets come in. But if you think again, you can. We'll start in verse 10 of Ezekiel 20. Here God is talking about ancient Israel. Now bear in mind, we learn a lot of things of what not to do by studying the history of ancient Israel. And sometimes we learn things we should do, but mostly it's what not to do. I guess Will Rogers was right. Nobody is useless. You can always serve as a bad example. So in verse 10, therefore I made them go out of the land of Egypt, and I brought them into the wilderness, and I gave them my statutes and showed them my judgments, which if a man do, he shall live by them. Notice that phrase. If you do God's way, you'll live by it. You'll thrive. It's living in the thriving sense. Moreover, I also gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between them and me, that they might know that I am the Lord who sanctifies them. Yet the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They did not walk in my statutes. They despised my judgments, which if a man does, he will live by them. Second time. And they greatly defiled my Sabbaths. Then I said I would pour out my fury on them in the wilderness to consume them. But I acted for my name's sake, that it should not be profaned before the Gentiles, in whose sight I had brought them out. So I raised my hand in an oath to them in the wilderness that I would not bring them into the land which I had given them, flowing with milk and honey, the glory of all lands, because they despised my judgments and did not keep my walk in my statutes, but they profaned my Sabbaths, for their heart went after their idols. Nevertheless, my eye spared them from destruction, and I did not make an end of them in the wilderness. He did make an end of the older generation, however, because the next verse indicates that. But I said to their children in the wilderness, do not walk in the statutes of your fathers, nor observe their judgments, nor defile yourselves with their idols. See, the children got to go on in. If you were 20 and under, you ended up into the promised land, provided you didn't rebel too badly along the way. And if you were older than that, then you died in the wilderness, with two exceptions: Joshua and Caleb, the only two that were above that age category. All the rest of that first generation out of the Exodus had to die in the sands of the Sinai because of their rebellion to God during the wandering years. That's sobering, but that's also a good lesson. Like I said, you can learn from a bad example. But I said to their children in the wilderness, verse 18, do not walk in the statutes of your fathers, nor observe their judgments, nor defile yourselves with their idols. I am the Eternal, your God. Walk in my statutes, keep my judgments and do them. Hallow my Sabbaths, and they will be a sign between me and you, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. And the Sabbath is a sign between us and God. We understand who God is because we keep the Sabbath, opening up our minds to His Word and to His truth. And God, of course, places His mark of ownership upon us because we keep the Sabbath. It's a vital aspect. But the issue and the lesson that we draw from this, which we could follow up, in other prophecies and in the histories of how Israel, even in the Promised Land, didn't keep God's Sabbath. They certainly didn't do it right in the wilderness, and that was part of the reason why in the rebellion, the older generation had to die before the rest of the nation could go into the Promised Land. Now, the Sabbath, then, is a marvelous time, and not to be defiled like the Israelites did. That's one of the key failings, in fact, of ancient Israel. It's also one of the key failings of modern Israel. The nations descended from Israel, and for that matter, is one of the key failings of mankind in general, Sabbath breaking. God does not take that lightly. And there will be consequences for our generation of history and the other generations before. But there will also be a day, as we kind of brought out in the Bible study this morning about the prophecies of the world tomorrow, there will also be a day when they will know the Sabbath. And they will enjoy the Sabbath as we enjoy it as God's people today. Let's look then at the Sabbath as that test commandment that God talked about there in Ezekiel. Let's go back to Exodus 31. And if this isn't a memory scripture, be sure to add it to your list in case we have a Bible quiz sometime or a quiz game at one of our socials this winter. We will have some Bible quiz games, by the way, over at the park for a little while for those who are interested. It's always fun to try to see how much you can remember different aspects of God's Word. Chapter 31 and verse 13. We'll start at verse 12. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak also to the children of Israel, saying, Surely my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Eternal who sanctifies you." The Sabbath is a sign between God and His people. We recognize God's ownership over us and lordship over us by keeping the Sabbath. Down through history, God's people were identified by the Sabbath. I'm talking now the true history of the true church. Sabbath keeping, when you start sorting through ecclesiastical or church history generally, most of it is going to be about the world's Christianity. So you're looking for the little bits of history that are the markers of the true church. And it will always be there because God said the gates of death or hell, the grave, would not prevail against it. It would always exist somewhere, but it would be a little flock. Sabbath keeping is one of the markers. It's not a surefire marker, but it is one of them. In other words, there are a few groups that keep the Sabbath that aren't a part of the church, but you go back far enough, you find out they were at one time. In almost every case. So it is an identifying sign between God and His people. God is understood by His people because we keep His Sabbaths, including the annual Sabbaths, the weekly Sabbaths to start, but then the annual holy days carry the weight of the Sabbath as well. Now, one example of that would be the Armstrongs, and I'm speaking of both Mr. and Mrs. in this instance, looking back many years, and here's a tidbit of church history. One of the very first feast sites, in fact, I believe it was the very first feast site, was in Oregon. It was in a place called Belknap Springs. It's about 80 miles out of Eugene, going straight west, up a river valley, the McKenzie River Valley. Going straight east. I have my east and west backwards sometimes, but you know what I mean. You couldn't go 80 miles west of Eugene, you'd be in the ocean. And it was at Belknap Springs in, I think it was 1951, Dr. Hay told us this one time, Herman Hay, that feast, they had services morning and afternoon and then a Bible study or something or another service in the evening. But in between, they would sit around and do impromptu Bible studies with Mr. Armstrong there and the several students of Ambassador College as the college got started. And it was in 1951 that the picture of God's plan of salvation as we understand it gelled. They were putting the pieces together. They understood the Sabbath, they were keeping the Feast of Tabernacles and the other holy days, and the more they kept them, the clearer it became until the understanding came clear about that time. And the final pieces moved into place of the God's plan of salvation. We are benefited from that. For us, you know, it's old knowledge because we've proven it as we came into the church, grew up in the church, and then, you know, took it on our own recognizance at the time of repentance and baptism. So God is understood by those who keep His Sabbaths, and that certainly has been the case in the modern era of the church. Some of God's truth was lost. That's why it came together. There were pieces missing. And that's partly because the church would get lax, and that was not the only time that happened going back further. One of the classes we had for the Challenger East program a couple of weeks ago was the true history of the true church. Our pastor over in Milwaukee, Dan Dowd, has done a lot of research on that. I've done the research on where the 12 apostles went, and then he picks up with John and starts following through the history of the church. The studies and knowledge of been done by various ones over the years, but we haven't always managed to keep copies of their research. So between the two of us, though, we presented the picture to our young adults at Challenger East. From the time of the Apostle John, of course we have a record of the other apostles and of Christ's ministry, and John was the last of 12 of the 12 apostles standing. From that time forward, you have to piece it together from the prophecies of the New Testament a little bit, and then from the actual study of the secular history or the non-church history of the church. Non-church history of the church. Now there's one for you. The writings of others other than the inspired record of the Bible, in other words. He covered the early years up into the Middle Ages, getting from the Paulicians to the Bogomils to the Waldensians and on down through the Middle Ages and finally into the beginnings of the Protestant Reformation in England, which didn't really get underway until the 1600s. They happened in the 1500s on the continent, but it was the 1600s in England. And that was after the English thought their Protestant Reformation took place already when Queen Elizabeth became queen. They ceased to be Catholic and became Anglican, Church of England. But there was another element of Reformation that came later because the true church, through persecutions, had moved out of Europe and into England, where it was also persecuted. And some of the ministers died in prison because they preached on the Sabbath. Some of the brethren then began to move. There was a church that was well known called the Mill Yard Church of God in a section of London called Mill Yard, logically enough. We heard about that and read about that in the 1980s. Was we had two branches of the previous historical branches of the church prior leading up to what was then Worldwide Church of God in Wisconsin. Church of God Seventh Day was present in some places, but also the Seventh Day Baptist movement was centered there by that time. Seventh Day Baptists had been a part of the true church as well. They had a library at their world headquarters in Janesville, Wisconsin. And it had the most amazing collection of old books. One was called Heresiography. I've told you about this book before. They had three copies of it. The first two were printed. They were second editions, which is pretty good, but first editions are really rare. And they're the most valuable. Second editions were printed in 1640. Printed in 1640. The first edition was printed 4 years earlier in 1636. But that was a report by Ephraim Paget of all the heresies in the world to the king, King James. Except that he meant heresies based on the doctrines of the Church of England, not heresies based on, you know, strictly what the Bible said. They also had another book there. As one day, a couple of our ministers, who are ministers-to-be, they are now, one of the older ministers from headquarters in Pasadena was there, and I was talking to their librarian, who we'd gotten to know, and I asked her, I said, do you know whatever happened to the recorder for the Mill Yard Church? See, in our readings, we found out that each one of the congregations had a recorder. It was a big, thick book, and everything was recorded in it. When they met for services on the Sabbath, how many were there, when somebody paid their tithes, there was marked there, or an offering was made, or if somebody was anointed because they were sick or was baptized, that was written in. If there were disfellowship, that was written in. If there was a marriage, that was written in. Births of children, their names and everything. It was the registry of the church, in other words. The recorder is what they called it. And so the librarian, and when I asked the question, she, just a minute, I'll be back in a few minutes. I have a run an errand. And she didn't usually just walk off like that, but she disappeared. And then I heard the elevator go down to the basement. And pretty soon she walked out of the elevator again. And she had at that time in her hands the recorder for the Mill Yard Church of God. That was the main congregation, as far as we can tell, in England at the time. It was from the Mill Yard area church that Stephen Mumford came over to America, and then other Seventh-day Baptists is what they labeled them as. They would have been Church of God members at that time. Seventh-day Baptist was the label they adopted in about 1800. So we found the recorder, and we stood there, and Mrs. Thornton would read a page, and I would read a page, and we turn it over, and we just read all the different things that took place while the others were listening. The true history of the true church is there. Sabbath keeping is one of the key markers. And we always look for that when we're tracking. Now, let's move to another section. Let's consider five principles of Sabbath keeping. In the art of Sabbath keeping, five key principles. The first one is rest. No, not right now. Stay awake for the rest of the sermon if you can. But in Genesis chapter 1, obviously, we're going to look at the basic passage that shows the principle, the guiding principle in that sense. It's law, but it's also a guiding principle in understanding how to keep the Sabbath, keep it well. Verse 1 of chapter 2 of Genesis, "Thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all the work which he had done." Did God need to rest? Did he technically need to rest? No. God has all energy pulsating through, well, probably doesn't have veins like we do, pulsating through him. You know, he never gets tired. We get tired because we're physical. God is spirit, doesn't get tired. But he rested anyway. His action became a precedent. His action, the precedent, became the law for man. He rested from the work which he had done. God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. We need to rest. God didn't need to, but he set an example for us. So rest is the first key principle. Secondly, not to work. Obviously, it logically flows from resting, because if you're resting, you're not usually not working. Unless you're growing laurels. If you're growing laurels, you can rest on those. Chapter 20 of Exodus. Right into the Ten Commandments now. Verse 8. "Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy." Now, that's normally what we quote. Yeah, this is the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. Well, that's the short version. Let's get the rest. "6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Eternal, your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your maid servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gate." Your stranger who is within your gates. "For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it." So you see how it's connected right back to Genesis chapter 2, with that last sentences there. So it is a day of doing no work, nor having employees doing your work for you. They get to rest as well. "Nor your beast of burden." Now, if you have regular cattle, they rest anyway whenever they want to. But if you have an oxen that pulls the plow or pulls a wagon, well, it gets to rest that day. It doesn't have to go out and pull the plow or the wagon for doing work. So not working is the second great principle of Sabbath keeping. Third great principle, Seek God and His ways, not our own pleasures. Seek God and His ways. Do not seek just our own pleasures. Although, when we understand, by the way, we're turning to Isaiah 58, Isaiah 5:8, when we understand the principle of the Sabbath, it becomes a pleasure to think about God and His ways. We'll begin at verse 13. Actually, it's verses 13 to 14 of Isaiah 58. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, you know, don't go tromping all over it, and from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and you call the Sabbath a delight, is a wonderful time, a holy day of the Lord, and honorable, and shall honor Him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words. Then you shall delight yourself in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the high hills of the earth and feed you with the heritage of Jacob, your father. The mouth of the Eternal has spoken. So it is a time when we seek God and His ways, and we don't do just our own pleasures. Now, that has lots of ramifications, but it isn't a day for our regular six-day-a-week pleasures and pastimes. It's a day of rest and reflection and marveling at God and His way. The fourth principle, we'll get more, by the way, a little bit more into the art of Sabbath keeping based on that third one, but the fourth principle is assemble to worship. Assemble to worship. Let's go back to the catalog chapter of God's Sabbath days, both the weekly and the annual, which is Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23, and we want to look at the first three verses. Now, as I said, this is the chapter that has all of God's annual holy days listed in it. As I said, it catalogs them in their order of sequence. But assembling to worship is a vital part of the Sabbath. Starting in verse 1 of Leviticus 23, and the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts or festivals of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts. So just as I said, it has all the holy days, all the annual holy days in it, all of God's feasts. But what's interesting is the first feast that God lists, the first festival. Verse 3, 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work on it. It is the Sabbath of the Lord in all your dwellings. It is a holy convocation. That's stated in verse 2 and in verse 3. That is also rendered a commanded assembly. Commanded assembly to worship God. That's where the holy part comes in. That's what a convocation is a commanded assembly. We are commanded to assemble, to be together whenever possible. Granted, there are times and places where we have brethren who can't simply go because of health reasons, maybe, or because they are geographically too far away to be able to assemble with other brethren. We all experience that once in a while when we are traveling and we end up someplace where there is no local congregation. We can't assemble then. The advent of high technology allows us to at least assemble to a certain degree through the internet to be able to watch church service, hear a sermon being given. We are able to do that. But where we are within reach of brethren, we need to be with brethren on the Sabbath day. Finally, number 5, the fifth principle of Sabbath keeping. This one we will find in Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10, verses 22 to 25. Hebrews 10, 22, 25. Okay, it's talking about how Christ serves as our high priest over the household of the house of God in verse 21. And then 22, we jump right into the middle of that sentence. Let us draw near with a true heart, a full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he is faithful who promised, and let us consider one another. Ah, here's the point where fellowship is commanded. Let us consider one another in order to stir up to love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. And the day of Christ's return is what is clearly implied here, which our brethren back through the ages, I'm sure, have always anticipated was in their day. Certainly the apostles did. And it was not until near the end of the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter's life and John himself that they realized they weren't coming up on the second coming of Christ. There was more to be fulfilled. Well, we look at those same scriptures and we don't see that much more that needs to be fulfilled before Christ's coming. And so, but God intended that to be the mindset of the brethren all through the many centuries that the true church has existed. So we gather on the Sabbath to strengthen and encourage each other. The fellowship of the brethren of like mind is a major part of the Sabbath. Okay, now with those five principles in mind, let's look at a couple of other key points about the Sabbath. First, we turn to Mark chapter 2. Right near the end. The Sabbath was made for man, verse 27. The Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Now, Christ gives an example of illustrating that. We'll go back and read that example. It happened in verse 23, it starts. It happened when he went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and as they went, his disciples began to pluck the heads of grain. Or if you have your King James open, it says the corn, the heads of corn. I have the New King James, so it says grain. Took me a long time to figure that out. Because when I read the King James Bible as a kid growing up on a corn farm in South Dakota, and it said corn, I assumed it meant corn. And it was not until I went to Ambassador College in England and had been there over a year, or nearly a year, I guess it was. I was then, by that time, at a part-time job working on the college research farm. And we took off one day to go to the National Agriculture Show, the Royal Agriculture Show, actually. We have state fairs in America, and many of our states are are the same size as England. Wyoming is one of them. And so it'd be like a state fair, except it was for the whole nation. So it was a big deal. You had all your farm equipment displayed there. You had all kinds of livestock, all the different breeds of cattle and horses and sheep and goats and hogs that were there on display and being shown. I met a bull, the biggest bull I ever saw. He's a Lincoln Red Shorthorn that stood 7 feet at the shoulder and weighed 3,600 weight. 100 weight means 112 pounds. So that's 3,600 pounds times 36 times 12 added to that. That was the biggest bovine I've ever stood beside. He was a pussycat. He was busy eating. You know, I mean, you can't stay that size if you don't stay busy eating. And so, you know, I could pat him on the shoulder. I was talking to these groomsmen that was looking after him, getting him ready for the show, which means walk around the ring, and then they judge them and give them. This was the champion bull. Then they had a dairy bull there. It was a Guernsey, and he probably if he broke 1,000 pounds or 1,200 pounds, that would be still it's pretty good size. He had two really strong English stockmen, and they had these would be like pickaxe handles. They were connected to a chain, and each of their chains went down through a set of chains around the horns of the Guernsey bull into a ring in his nose. And they were pulling back on those chains, pulling his nose back, because he wanted to fight everybody and everything. Dairy bulls are dangerous, and Guernseys are the most dangerous, even though they're the smallest. So we got to see that. We got to see the king, or no, not the king, they don't have a king. We had to see the queen and Prince Philip. There at the Royal Agriculture Show. But it was on the way up that I learned the lesson about corn. I'm sitting between two brothers, a Whitaker brothers from Yorkshire, which is in the north of England, but they were in the church and they had come down and had full-time jobs working on our research farm. And so one would say, oh, look at that field of corn over there. And I would look across real quick to see what it was. I didn't see any corn. I didn't see anything at all. And I thought, maybe it's that stuff in the distance, you know, another field or two over. And pretty soon they saw a field of corn on the other side that they were admiring. They were going up the motorway. There wasn't any corn out, just a wheat field or barley or whatever. And they're calling it corn. I said, I don't see any corn. And they laughed because they called me a Yank and all those kinds of things. Because they realized what I didn't know was when they said corn, they mean grain. When we say corn, then we mean something entirely different. They call our corn maize. So they were amazed that I thought their grain was corn. Or rather, I was amazed that they thought our grain was whatever, lest I get myself turned around in that. So the grain, they were going through the cornfields or the grain fields, and the disciples, and boy, I read this as a teenager, and I think they were plucking heads of corn or ears of corn and eating them. I said, where did you stop to wash off all the juice you get from the corn? I've done that. This, you know, grab an ear of sweet corn when you're hungry and you're out in the field, or even field corn, and we'd yank the shucks off of it, and we'd eat it. If it was in the roasting ear stage in that time of the summer, we did that every once in a while. But you just got covered with corn milk as you're squirting those kernels. And so I wonder, why would they do that? They get into a terrible mess. What I didn't know was that it meant grain, and it was barley, more than likely. And they was snapping off a head of barley that was nearly ripe, but probably not quite, close to the roasting ear, if you could call it that, of barley or wheat. And they would rub the head in their hands like this to break off the long whiskers of the barley, that long stem that sticks out of the grain, and the husk. And they'd throw the handful of grain in their mouth, and they'd chew it and eat it. Very tasty, very nutritious. And it was a free snack. And they're like, why are they stealing grain? Well, they're not. You can go back into Leviticus and Deuteronomy, you'll find God had a law that passersby could eat snacks literally out of the farmer's field as they're going by it. That was okay. It was similar to the law of gleaning. It's interesting that in agriculture is the only place where God allows, in fact, God sanctions sloppy work. Do not be too diligent in your harvesting. Leave the corners of your fields. If you drop something or it falls off the wagon, oh, who cares? Leave it there. In fact, Boaz told his harvesters, the young men who were scything his barley, he said, I want you boys to be really careless today. Just drop a lot of stuff, because Ruth was gleaning behind them. And you leave her alone. She gets to glean there. I want her to. So, you know, that's the one place you can be sloppy in your work, and it's a good thing. About the only place that I know of in God's way of life. So whatever the case, they were eating the barley that they were allowed to eat, and they were doing it on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees, however, they had taken the Sabbath, and they'd come to worship the Sabbath more than they worshiped God. That was one of the Pharisees' fundamental problems. There were things that were more important than actually trying to understand God's will. And by going through these rituals, the way they kept the Sabbath was one of them, then they felt more righteous themselves. They weren't as concerned whether or not God felt they were more righteous or not. And so the Pharisees took them to task for that. And the Pharisees said to him, look, what are they doing? It's not lawful on the Sabbath. Not lawful to the Pharisees. It's lawful to God. And David said, have you never read what David did when he was in need and hungry, and those with him, that he went into the house of God? That would be the tabernacle, not the temple. The temple hadn't been built until Solomon's time. Went into the tabernacle of God in the days of Abiathar the priest, and ate the showbread, which is not lawful to eat except for the priests, and also gave some to those who were with him. His showbread were loaves of bread that were baked every week, and they were placed on golden tables inside the tabernacle. Later in the temple, the same thing. And they were a grain offering to God. Now, after they had sat there a certain period of time, then they were taken off, and the priests could eat them. And they would be putting on new showbread. show bread because it's bread on show, as it were, in offering to God. And it was only for priests. But David was running from Saul's executioner force and his young men with him, and they were out of blood sugar and they needed food. And so Abiathar said, "Here, eat the show bread." And on top of that, he says, "Where's your sword?" And David said he didn't have one. And he said, "Well, here, you can have this one. You earned it." He gave him Goliath's sword. You remember the story. You can read about it in the book of Samuel. So Christ drew a lesson from that. Now, this is Christ drawing the lesson. And he said to the Pharisees, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. God gave the Sabbath as a gift to man. And the Son of Man is also the Lord or the Master of the Sabbath." Jesus Christ defines the Sabbath for us. So the Sabbath then is a great blessing. And, you know, in a sense, as it would have been viewed from that time, these disciples were eating out on the Sabbath. Because they were snatching grain and rubbing their hands to get it edible and then eating it. The Sabbath was made for man. We operate on a seven-day cycle. And increasingly, they're finding more and more that our body's rhythms are based on that seven-day cycle. And if you don't have a rest period, you start to dysfunction. In other words, you don't function at nearly the intellectual level that you do if you take a day to rest. And there have been books and books and books. Over the past 20 or 30 years, a lot of research has been done. Not trying to prove the Sabbath, but it ended up proving the value of the rest. And again, in all questions about the Sabbath, Christ is the boss. Not us. Not our feelings of, you know, trying to feel more righteous than others. That's a Pharisee trick. Avoid that. You can see through the Pharisees. It's good to study what they did so that you know, in the Bible here and see how Christ countered it. Now, let's apply the art of Sabbath keeping. We move to this section of the sermon. Again, we're going to operate off of Isaiah 58, so we'll drop back there, and then you can refer to it just occasionally, verses 13 and 14. That's the key scripture to capture the spirit of the Sabbath. Turning away our foot from the Sabbath so we don't tromp on it and break it, and not doing our own, just our pleasure on the Sabbath. Now, as I said earlier, as we live God's way of life, if we're growing spiritually, more and more, the things that please God please us. And then the Sabbath is a pleasure. That's not a sin. That kind of pleasure is okay. It's using the Sabbath for our other regular things that would be fine on other days, but on the Sabbath, something you don't do, because it's a day of rest, a day of focusing on God, not on ourselves. So we turn away our foot from the Sabbath means treating the Sabbath as holy time, not just personal time. From doing our pleasure on God's holy day, the Sabbath is God's day. It's not for our personal entertainment or occupational pursuits. It's God's day. We call the Sabbath a delight, as this passage says. That means capture the joy of the Sabbath, of a day set aside to seek God in His ways and not our own. I think we do have a sense of that, especially as you've lived God's way of life for a period of time. But even newer brethren rapidly catch on to this, and they begin to realize what a high, in the positive sense, day the Sabbath is when they can come to church and they get to visit with the brethren and they get to share their challenges and trials or share their joys and get to know each other and talk about God and His coming kingdom and anticipate the feast this time of year. We get to looking forward to that. It's a day to honor God, honor Him, not doing our own ways or thinking our own thoughts, not finding your own pleasure, or nor speaking our own words. You know, there's a scripture that says, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And what we yak about is what we, you know, what we value. Out of the abundance of the mouth, the heart speaks too. And so, excuse me, it is not a day to just talk business, sports, or about self. Now, I say not a day to talk about business or sports. There are times, though, when you can reflect on business, not what you're doing if you have a business or, you know, whatever career you have, but you can analyze, and this is a good thing to do, especially as we get closer to the feast and picturing the millennium, analyze how your job or your business will be done in the world tomorrow. And think about that. Are you involved in transportation? What would transportation be like? And you go back and you try to think through what blend of technologies will God allow to exist in the millennium? We have a lot of technologies that are counterproductive to the actual quality of life. Just because we can do it doesn't necessarily mean we should do it as human beings. So to analyze in the world from the viewpoint of God's kingdom to come, you know, that's proper Sabbath fodder. For example, in agriculture, that was my background. How big of a feedlot could you have on the Sabbath? And of course, the answer is, well, you probably won't need a feedlot at all because there'll be a lot more people involved in agriculture. So you'll have their own livestock and they won't need it. But if even today, if you have a feedlot, you don't want a feedlot that requires that you feed the animals constantly. So you spend 12 hours feeding them. Most feedlots operate that way. They feed them constantly. You know, they have employees running the corn silage and the grain and the antibiotics because they want to have, you know, live standing animals. They're propped up on antibiotics when they go to the slaughterhouse. And you get to eat those for lunch. You wonder where the beef went. Well, it's in between the antibiotics. But you analyze it. If you were to have a feedlot, and we had a small one, and so we analyzed how much work we had to do. We could load our feed wagon in the morning, and we could feed the cattle on Sabbath or on Friday afternoon, and it would be ready to go Sabbath morning. So that minimized the amount of work that had to be done. And then we only fed them that one time during the day with the corn silage and ground corn and ground hay that we had. Same would be with a dairy farm. You know, a lot of dairy farms today, they're dairy factories. They're not really farms at all. The cattle are milked three times a day, not twice. Not like the old rhythms of the past, because they can get another part of a gallon out of them if they work them that hard. And they milk some places, I think, 24 hours a day, but at least 12 hours to 18 hours a day. Just milk, 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 milk. That's not good for the animals. It just wrings the good out of them, and they don't have very much quality of life. And you do have to regard the life of your beast. That's what the proverb says. The righteous man regards the life of his beast. And his beef, too. Yes. Beef and beasts. So you would have to analyze a dairy. Well, I can't have a dairy that's going to consume too much time on the Sabbath. You're right. Now, taking those principles, shift them to any other occupation that you might have where you've got livestock that require on you. Businesses that just have machines, turn them off, turn them back on when you come back to work on Sunday or Monday. But when you have livestock, you have to analyze those things. Analyze which kinds of industry will exist in the world tomorrow based on the various principles you can imagine and think about. Then there was one other element back from Isaiah 58. You shall delight yourself in the Lord. That is a key forgotten ingredient in deciding what is the Sabbath is for and what to do on it and what not to do. We delight ourselves in God. We don't delight ourselves in the cartoons. We don't delight ourselves in the video games. We don't delight ourselves in too much news. Some news is all right. So those are the key elements out of that passage. Now let's look at the Sabbath begins at sundown, because God reckons from sundown to sundown. So we would call Friday night is actually Sabbath time. Our modern nomenclature for Friday night after the sundown. So that's our Friday then is our preparation day. The sixth day is a preparation day for the seventh day. This is the advice we have always given. You clean your house ahead of time. If you have to work on Friday and you're not going to have time to clean, especially wintertime, when you get home, do it on Thursday evening. You know, stretch your preparation time back a little ways. If there are major foods you want to prepare for a meal, well, do the heavy baking and roasting and things ahead of time to minimize the amount of food preparation that will be needed. Wind down as the Sabbath begins to set on Friday. Start to shift mental gears. Start to think about God's Sabbath. Sort of whet your appetite for it. Make sure the chores are all done. Maybe prepare a special Sabbath meal for the family or a special Sabbath cup of espresso. I like that. nobody takes me up on the espresso much, but I do. But whatever the case, something that makes the Sabbath special for you. What about entertainment and information? TV, computer, radio, phone, which is both TV, computer, and radio, as well as a phone. We can use information but off of the media, but not entertainment on the Sabbath, not entertainment that is apart from God. Sabbath music, what kind of Sabbath music? Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, oh, there's a voice from the past. No, that was rock. That's not Sabbath music. Was it Mick Jagger that couldn't get no satisfaction? No, that's not Sabbath music. How about I got tears in my ears, I'm lying on my back in my bed crying over you, and I don't know which country star recorded that one. No, that's not Sabbath music either. Now, again, you analyze the music you listen to, and it's good to listen to some, but it's not the usual, it's not the loud, or the raucous, or the sinful lyrics. It is restful and peaceful. It's a day of rest. Now, this is where classical music comes into its own. Certain elements of classical music don't have lyrics. And sometimes if, we've grown up cutting our teeth on some other kind of genre music, you have to learn to appreciate it. But when you do, you find the restful music that is inspiring and pleasant to listen to and helps you to reflect on God and His way. What about video games? Especially violent video games. I don't know what the latest ones are right now. Somebody told me one of them the other day. But, they're normally, what video games came from, the main video games, especially the violent ones? Simulators for soldiers. Americans don't raise natural-born killers. Now, we're getting enough people from other cultures where they do have those, apparently. But America has not typically had those. Bonnie and Clyde were an exception. Bonnie was really an exception, especially to be natural-born killers. That's not the American way. In the Vietnam era, there was a Colonel Coleman. First name escapes me at the moment, but he did extensive research because he was one of the men that was tasked by the Army to train American soldiers to kill. And the way he did it is they killed targets. They depersonalized who they're shooting at. But you got to identify the target. An enemy combatant, i.e. soldier, that's your target. Somebody who's out in his rice paddy working his rice, that's not a target. Kids are not a target. Women are not a target, except, that all those, they use that against the American soldiers in the Vietnam War. So they would do pop-up shooting, instinctive shooting. Instead of careful rifle practice, they learned the basics, but then they would teach instinctive shooting, because in jungle warfare, the targets are going to come up really quick and close and deadly. So one of the things they taught them for the instinctive part is they would take a regular BB gun, just the old Daisy BB gun that you'd cock with a lever, and they took the sights off of them, and then they taught them to shoot instinctively at aerial targets. So the sergeants would snap aspirin tablets in their air, and the soldiers were supposed to get good enough to shoot the tablet out of the air with a BB gun. Annie Oakley could do it standing backwards. It's possible. And in fact, they got really good at it. So they could shoot instinctively. Then the only thing they had to think about was target or no target. That was the way they had to be trained. Now, after Colonel Coleman did his work in the Vietnam area, then they began to develop video games that came along not too many years later. They were used for the same kind of purpose: identifying the target and quickly shooting. And it totally engrosses. A soldier is on task and keyed up. And exactly what the video game does as well. And violence is an integral part of a lot of them. Violence and sexual violence. We don't do any of those kind of games at any time, let alone on the Sabbath. Well, what about other kind of video games? Why? Read the book. Read the book on the Sabbath. Put those aside. They're too intense. They're all designed to be intense, so they don't sell, and that's why you don't have one of those. And never, here's another concern I have about video games. I've been watching this happen for over 10 years now. Well, 10 years. 10 years ago was the first time I saw it happen at the feast. Young couple came in, had two little kids, handed in their video games. This is when they had little tablet video games that had come out. put the earbuds in their ears. As soon as they got in their chair, the kids stayed there 2 hours, didn't bother mom and dad, and they didn't hear a thing about the church service. Never heard the hymns, never noticed that people stood up to sing, never heard anything the minister was saying. He said, well, yeah, but they were toddlers. They're too young to know anything the minister was saying, or little kids. So I'll give you a story. This was the Feast of 2000. We were in Bend, Oregon. And I gave a sermon on the history of the millennium, because of 2000, the millennium was just turning over. Maybe it was 99. I guess it was 99. We're coming up on Y2K. And the great scare of Y2K. Remember that? So I said, will the real millennium please stand up? That was the title. I went through millennialism. There have been many people who believed in the millennium. There are now. Baptists generally do, because the Baptists at one time were connected to the true church. That's a long, long, long time ago. But they still are typically premillennials. Remember that Christ returns before the millennium is a premillennial. Well, like we are. We believe he returns before the millennium, because that's what the Bible says. But there were various kinds of millennialists as well. There were postmillennialists. This ended pretty much in World War I. Because it was such a nasty war. The postmillennialists looked at the colonial powers of Europe, thinking that they were bringing Christianity to the savage nations of the earth in Africa and in Asia and various places, and that things would get better and better and better, and then at the end of 1,000 years, Christ would return. And you think, where do they get that? I don't know. They thought it up. Who knows where false doctrines come from? And then there are the other ones who are called amillennial. Millennial. Just the letter A in Latin, that means no millennium. And that's where the Roman Church and a lot of the mainstream Christianity, they think it's just a metaphor. It doesn't really happen at all. Then the millennium, if it's premillennial, then you've got the tribulation. So the Great Tribulation, that is believed in by those who are millennialists typically, they recognize that there's a tribulation. Usually they think it's 7 years instead of 3.5 years that we think it is. And they think that some of them think Christ comes before the tribulation, some in the middle of the tribulation, some at the end of the tribulation. So you're either a pre-tribulationist, mid-tribulationist, or post-tribulationist. We're post-tribulational. He comes at the end of the tribulation, beginning of the millennium. And we believe that we are living in the end of the age. Apocalyptic. Now, if you read my little article in the announcements, it explains apocalypse and apocalyptic. They both actually mean revelation, but the way it's used, it talks about the end of the world. So we are post-tribulational, premillennial, apocalyptics. There was an 8-year-old girl in the audience. We found out about it from her mother about two months after the feast. She wrote us an email. And she was sitting there playing with her dolls while I was going through the history of the millennium in the sermon. And she said, why doesn't she listen? You know, I want her to know this. She's 8 years old. She should learn this. And she was right. What surprised her was her daughter. It's 2 months later, she came out of her bedroom. He says, you know, Mom, I've been thinking about it. You know what we are? She says, no, honey, what are we? He said, we're post-tribulational, premillennial, apocalyptics. That's what we are. In other words, while she was playing with her dolls, sitting on the floor there in the auditorium for the feast, this was out in Oregon, she heard this fairly detailed explanation, that, which wasn't directly targeted to the kids, that part of the sermon, some of it was. And she got all of that because she was sitting there without the earbuds stuck in her ears so she could hear it. So don't tell me the kids don't pick things up at church. That's why it's such a tragedy when you see the video games with the earbuds stuck in the ears of the children. They don't hear anything. It's like they're not there. All those years that happens. That's not good. Not good at all. Playing sports on the Sabbath. What about a little bit of, you know, impromptu basketball or football? Well, how about a little impromptu mountain climb up the north face of Everest? It's a day of rest, reflecting on God. I mean, the sports can wait. It'll be there waiting for us tomorrow. And no fishing, no hunting. The fish always breathe a sigh of relief. Sorry, they don't breathe, do they? Not in the normal sense. And the animals, because us great hunters aren't going to be terrifying them during the Sabbath. Somebody else will, but we won't. News shows on TV. Watching the news. And we are to be watched, therefore, and pray always. You'll be accounted worthy to escape all these things. Luke 21:36. within reason, but don't just devour all the bad news stories that you can on the Sabbath. You know, catch up on the news, think about it, but then go back and see things as God sees them. How does God reflect on that? Don't spend too much time. What about programs about creation? That might be okay a little bit, but hours and hours and hours of creation videos, that's going to detract from the Sabbath, because we need time to actually read the Word, read God's Word, get our noses into the Bible, reflect on those things, talk about them as family, talk about family things, anticipating the coming feast, all the different things that we have to do and look forward to. It's also a good time, though, this kind of ties in with information age, email fellowship, where you can write a note to somebody. It's even better when you can write one and mail it a few days earlier so it arrives sometimes close to the Sabbath. But to sit down and write those on the Sabbath for the next Sabbath, or to email someone, that's beneficial as well. Just don't let it consume all of your time. What about God thinking about God as creator and the creation? You know, you could take a restful walk in the woods, but not a major hike. Leave the north face of Everest. I don't know about the south face. If you just went a little ways, it might be okay. I've never been on the south face of Everest. Never been on the north face either. Or the west or the east, but, you know, a walk is not a major hike. Teach your children about all the things that God has made. When you have children, to teach your grandchildren when you get a chance. Read the creation scriptures. This is part of the Sabbath. We're honoring our Creator. Creation videos, you know, have a benefit, but just, again, not overwhelming to take up too much time on the Sabbath. Let's go to another aspect. Study and meditation. Sabbath is made for reading the Bible. That's a really good time. We read it every day, but on the Sabbath we can pause from our other busy pursuits to think more deeply about it. Using church literature as a study guide is beneficial. Catching up on, you know, some of the articles in Beyond Today magazine, that's good. Read and think about God's plan, what He is doing, and the mission that we have to make that plan of God's coming kingdom clear to mankind. Reflect on what this is a great one for with small children as well, and well, big children too, each and every one of us. Reflect on what God has done for you and your family and for the church. Reflect on that. Reflect on what He will do with us and through us in this age, spreading the true gospel of His kingdom and then in the world tomorrow. So that's study and meditation. How about hospitality and fellowship? If sometimes the Sabbath will give you a little extra time to visit some of the widows and the sick who need visiting, and maybe your schedule doesn't allow you to get to them till then, or write a letter or card of encouragement to someone. Picnic in the park, like we're going to do after services here today. Talk about the world's problems in the light of the solutions that Christ is going to bring in the world tomorrow. That's a great way to analyze the world situation or world news. Get together to eat with other brethren, sometimes to eat out. And if you don't, there are some brethren who feel that they can't eat out on the Sabbath. No, that's fine. The disciples would have been considered eating out on the Sabbath, though, to be snapping the heads off corn in those days. There were no restaurants in that part of the country. So the Pharisees took them to task on that. So don't be Pharisaic about things, but, you know, it's appropriate to eat out from time to time. Eat someplace where it's quiet, where you can actually hear yourself think, and you can hear others talk. Reverence for God's sanctuary. Here we are in the hall. This is God's house here in North Canton while we're here. And likewise, our locations in Wheeling, in Youngstown, and over in Pittsburgh, and all of our congregations. So we need to approach the church service with a positive attitude, respectful approach, and a positive attitude to learn God's way, dress and groom accordingly, appropriately. You know, there was a dress code back in the days of the priests. The priests wore undoubtedly good quality woolen garments, but when they went into the temple of God, which was God's house then, they had a change from their woolen clothes to their linen clothes. They had uniforms that they had to put on. And then they wore them while they were there, and when they got done, while they were doing their duties in the temple, whether it was a Sabbath or the other days too. It was God's house and God's presence was there. And they had to respect that. If they didn't respect that, they got fried. like Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron. I don't know if it was fried, it might have been electrocuted, we don't exactly, but whatever. You know, they died as God struck them down because they did not respect his tabernacle. Consequently, dress and groom appropriately, shirt and tie and nice slacks for men, typically tropical dress shirts are appropriate and in their venues, usually a jacket too. I'll tell you a story. Mr. Armstrong was meeting with, I think it was Menachem Begin, there's a name out of the past. He was the prime minister of Israel when they made their peace treaty with Egypt, which is dissolved now. But that was back in 1977-78. Before that, he was serving in another capacity in the government, and Mr. Armstrong met with him at one point. And then he got a call while Mr. Armstrong was talking to him. He said, "Oh, I have to excuse myself. I need to go meet with the prime minister." And he started out the door, and Israeli don't wear ties. I don't know why. They just not their culture. Everybody that's from a different culture wears shirt and tie, but they wear open neck shirts. And he came running back and he said, "Well, I'm going to see the prime minister. I must wear my jacket." And he put his jacket on to go with his open neck shirt. So again, there was a standard there. The Sabbath is as well. For ladies, you know, a nice dress or suit or pantsuit that you can afford. Modesty obviously is important. No low-cut necklines, no cleavage, none of that stuff. Modest hem length, etc. You know, we have a dress code like that for the United Youth Camps, of what the kids can wear to church at camp. It's a very reasonable dress code, and it's worth knowing about because I've just summarized the gist of it here for you, and the kids are happy about it at camp. Then it teaches very great lessons, decently and in order. Come, be decent, as we use the term, in the way you've dressed, and act decent, as we use the term, respectful when you're at services. And we need to communicate on to the other generations that. Then we finally come down to the ox in the ditch principle. That's in Luke chapter 14. I won't read it. I'll just summarize it really quickly. You read it. It's the first six verses. He's taking the Pharisees again to task. In this case, he had healed a man, and they were upset about that. You know, when Christ healed a man, he said, "Be healed." That's all it was. Maybe he laid hands and prayed, and he did that at times. But it wasn't what you call great physical exertion. But the Pharisees were furious every time he healed somebody on the Sabbath. To them, that was work. And Christ explained the principle of the ox in the ditch. Which of you, having an ox, does not on the and it gets caught, stuck in the ditch, does not pull it out on the Sabbath? You don't let your ox stay there in the ditch, stuck in the mud where it can't move and sort of panicking. You don't leave it there. You go and rescue it, and you pull it out. He says, how much more important are people than oxen? So that's an important lesson that we can draw from it. We once had a cow that was an ox in the ditch on the Sabbath. I was driving the feed wagon to go feed the cattle and came around the corner, and there she was across the ravine from me. There was a swamp in the ravine, and she was just up above the swamp where the cattle came down from the pasture to the tank of water next to the spring and down there. And she had laid down to have a calf. It wasn't a first calf heifer. This was a cow. And I don't know why she did that, because first calf heifers did things like that. They didn't know where they were supposed to do. So we had to deliver calves constantly because we bought two-year-old heifers because nobody else wanted to calve them out. We could get them cheap and build a herd that way. Well, this cow had laid down on the slope, and as she was straining to give birth, she rolled over backwards and landed in basically a trench that the cows had made when the wet ground. And it had on the shallow side, it was about that high up, and on the top side, it was way high up, like this. And she was laying there, and who knows how long. I could tell she was still alive, so I got my father. He came around with a tractor. We were all about getting her out of there and trying to keep her alive. Calf was partly out. It was already dead. We could tell that. She didn't have horns. The polled Hereford. So they don't have horns. Most Herefords do, but not the pulled ones. So we put a log chain around her neck and moved it into position as carefully as we could. That's hard. That's the only way we could get her out, then pulled her up the slope by her neck slowly to a relatively flat spot. And we delivered the calf. She was in hypothermia because it had been cold the night, so she probably was there for hours. So then we did the other thing that kind of addled the poor girl. We went and got some old hay bales from 2 or 3 years old in a stack that wasn't far away, and we made a big ring around her and then turned them on fire, put them on fire. She was in a ring of fire. And livestock doesn't like fire. They don't like being around fire. They don't like having fire all the way around them. Without a lot of training, they stay away from fire. And she went kind of nuts, but she couldn't do anything because she couldn't get up. But she did get warm, and that saved her life. Now, that was all the work we did on that. All had to be done on the Sabbath to save that cow's life. And she turned out to be a good cow in the years ahead. She raised a lot of healthy calves, always in our milk cow corral, and she had bugged her eyes out, I think, from being upside down so long, which affected her vision, and she had changed her personality. She got a little bit mean, and if she had a calf, or if she thought she had a calf with her, she didn't like anybody being in the corral besides the other cattle. So we would walk into the corral. We never put our cows in the barn. They get soft. If you milk them in the barn, they stand in the corral wherever they were, and we'd sit down and milk. But we always would figure out where the bug-eyed mean cow, was our nickname for it, was, and we'd watch her out of the corner of our eyes while we're talking, my brother and I. And if she started towards us, especially when she had a calf by her side, you got out of the vent, you went over the fence immediately. Even if you had 3 gallons of milk in your bucket, you went over the fence with the bucket. That was all the result of having saved her life as an ox in the ditch. And it was a good lesson, though. Sabbath planning is important. You know, prepare your life through the week to prepare for God's Sabbath day. Savor this marvelous blessing and learn the art of Sabbath keeping. It is an art form. The art in the ultimate sense of righteousness is the art of being more and more like Christ and the Father. And the Sabbath day, with all that it has for us, and following these principles enables us to be more and more like Christ himself.